This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As you've heard, there were more attacks on London's transport system earlier today, much smaller explosions, and most importantly, there were no fatalities and apparently only a few injuries. We'll bring you an update and analysis later in the program, but while so much attention has been focused on terrorism, Afghanistan, and Iraq over the past few years, we want to spend some time over the next few weeks to concentrate on what many believe will be a more important story over the long run. China is already among the biggest economies in the world, and it's growing fast. It's a leader in technology and innovation, not just manufacturing. It's among our major creditors and, some say, an emerging strategic rival. It's the world's biggest exporter and potentially the world's biggest market. It also has serious problems with human rights, workers' rights, political expression, inequality, environmental issues, and more. Whether you see an awakening China as an opportunity or a threat, it will be a major player in the 21st century. Trying to make sense of this, we begin an ongoing series of discussions on the challenge of China. Today we'll talk with Clyde Prestowitz. He first went to Beijing as part of a U.S. government trade delegation in the Reagan administration. He's the founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute, and he's watched China change over the years. He'll join us in a few minutes, and of course we want to hear from you. If you have questions about China's rapidly developing economy, its advantages, and its problems, give us a call. We'd especially like to hear from those of you who do business there. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. We begin with Bill Powell, Time Magazine's correspondent in Shanghai, where it's 2 o'clock in the morning. He'll bring us up to date on a couple of developments in China. Bill, thanks very much for staying up to speak with us.
Not at all. Good afternoon.
For many years, China pegged its currency, the yuan, at a fixed rate against the U.S. dollar. After long and loud complaints from Washington, Beijing announced a more flexible currency system. What do they do? How important is it?
Well, they have revalued the yuan, or the renminbi, as it's known here, very slightly, by about 2%. The dollar will decline slightly against the yuan, making the United States exports to China thereby slightly cheaper, Chinese exports to the United States slightly more expensive, thereby possibly reducing a little bit of pressure on the bilateral trade deficit that the U.S. runs with China. I suspect, Neil, that if anything, the political voices in Washington will say that this is not nearly enough. I mean, I think Washington was looking for 5%, perhaps 10%. China threw them a very meager bone here. You're right that they were under intense pressure to do something. It seems to me they've done the absolute kind of minimum they could have done, because they just really do not want to do anything that will disrupt the economic growth that continues in this place.
And this is a long way from allowing their currency to float in value.
Right, right. Basically, it's what's called a managed float. They say it will be permitted to float 3% a day. Even some people I've spoken to just tonight, some economists doubt that even that will be likely. It's a very manageable float. It's a slight revaluation, some more flexibility built in, and we will just have to see going forward whether this is the first revaluation of several to come, as some hedge funds are betting and arguing, or whether this is kind of a one-off shot and likely to be status quo from here for quite some time.
Yesterday, a U.S. diplomat was pulled in to hear complaints in Beijing about the Defense Department's recent report about the Chinese military. The report said that China was spending a great deal more than it publicly disclosed.
Right. I think that there are two issues here. Well, really, the primary issue is Taiwan. And China's defense buildup, and it is a defense buildup, from it should be said, a relatively low base, is aimed primarily at being able to they would say defend Taiwan, to basically take Taiwan in any potential conflict with the United States. I think the Pentagon report interestingly says that they're still not at that point, that should the U.S. intervene, and our policy basically is that we would, they're still not at that point, but are rapidly moving up the technology spectrum and the spending spectrum to try to be able to do so. I think it is likely that the Pentagon's probably right that China doesn't disclose fully its spending. On the other hand, China is probably right in saying, look, we were a poor country. We are now getting richer, and we have every right to upgrade our military. This is, you know, a glass half full or half empty scenario.
Should be pointed out there's a black budget the Pentagon doesn't admit to either. So
correct.
Maybe not the same size as China's, but nevertheless.
Right.
What's the state? There are tensions between the United States and China, but next week there's going to be the six-party talks with North Korea. The United States sees China as absolutely key to getting North Korea to get rid of its nuclear weapons program. What's the state of U.S.-Chinese relations now?
I think not as good as they were, say, a year ago, but still not terrible. I think the news today about the currency is an example of that. It is a move by the Chinese to try to say to the U.S., look, we're trying to work with you. The North Korea talks fall into the same boat. I think the Chinese actually do not feel that they are critical to those talks. I think the Chinese feel that it is up to the U.S. To talk face to face with North Korea and cut a deal. Whether the Chinese are underplaying their own clout there is debatable. I think the Bush administration's relative calm, I would say, at this point, amid the relative hysteria about the possible takeover of a U.S. oil company by effectively a state-owned company here in China, has been a signal to the Chinese that okay, we have Congress over here, and they will say and do what they say and do, but we understand that this is a multifaceted strategic relationship. Hu Jintao, the president of China, the premier of China, is coming to Washington in September, and we understand that we need to do business on a whole range of fronts. So I think the administration is trying to keep it together here with China, and basically I would give them, you know, sort of fair grades on that at this point.
And the last word has yet to be made on the Unocal sale. Chevron's still in the game, and we'll see what happens there. Bill Powell, thanks very much. We appreciate you staying up to talk with us.
Thank you.
Bill Powell is Shanghai correspondent for Time magazine. Clyde Prestowitz joins us now here in Studio 3A. He's the founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute, a Washington think tank, and he's the author of a new book, 3 Billion New Capitalists, The Great Shift of Wealth and Power to the East. Thanks very much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
As we mentioned earlier, you served as a counselor to the Secretary of Commerce during the Reagan administrations back in the 1980s. We're on one of the first trade missions to China. You described landing there as a dusty airfield and thinking, you know, how could these people be seen as a threat?
It was a cow pasture. And as we drove into Beijing, at first I thought that the authorities had removed all the cars from the roads for our motorcade. But as we got into Beijing, I realized that there just weren't any cars in this country, nor were there stoplights. There were millions and millions of bicycles, and everyone riding the bicycles were all black, and everyone riding the bicycles was clothed in a black Mao suit. So you had this image of just waves of black moving down the streets. No high-rise buildings. It was a very primitive place.
And now you say people who come to China after not being there for 6 months don't recognize the place.
It changes every month. And I was just in Shanghai, and I rode the 300-mile-an-hour maglev train from Shanghai Airport to downtown Shanghai past, you know, as many skyscrapers as there are in Manhattan. I mean, just an amazing transformation.
How did the Chinese do it?
Well, two things. One is they studied the Asian model very carefully. You remember Japan had a miracle in 1964, and then you had the tigers, Korea and Taiwan and Singapore. And the Chinese looked at that very carefully, and they said, well, you know, we're Asians too. We can do the same thing. And secondly,
they had a slightly different political system.
Well, they did, but they, and they still do. But in a way, they changed that political system. I think the father of modern China is not Mao Zedong, it's Deng Xiaoping, who succeeded Mao. And he made two, you know, kind of critical statements. One was, it doesn't matter whether a cat is black or white as long as it catches mice. That was a statement of pragmatism rather than communist ideology. And out of that statement, we got Chinese, what was it? We got socialism with Chinese characteristics, which is you could interpret as capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, he made the statement that to get rich is glorious, basically blessing capitalism. And from that, China has then gone forward, and it has used the power of its government to marshal resources. It has used the tremendous entrepreneurial talents of its people, and it has followed the lessons that it learned from watching Japan and Singapore.
We're talking with Clyde Prestowitz. His new book, 3 Billion New Capitalists, not just talking about China, but that's a major element of his book. And when we come back, we'll take your calls on this emerging, awakening nation, a major player in the 21st century. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can send us email as well, TOTN@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Look at almost any graph of economic indicators for China, and you'll find a steep curve climbing ever more steeply upward. Manufacturing, foreign investment, cell phone, and car ownership all are soaring. We just got this email from a listener named Paul. My company sources our products from a Shanghai-based manufacturer. I visited there for the first time in May. I'm going again next month. China today is quite simply an economic juggernaut. State-of-the-art manufacturing facilities, brand new infrastructure, cheap labor, a Western attitude about doing business. Our policymakers should dedicate more time to our relationship with China. The G8 pales in comparison. Our guest this hour is Clyde Prestowitz. He's the author of 3 Billion New Capitalists. If you'd like to join us, you can also send us an email, TOTN@npr.org, or give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@npr.org. And let's get a caller on the line. This is Oren. Oren's calling from Minneapolis.
Yeah, hi. I'm on a cell phone. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you fine.
Great. I'm a professor at the Wuhan University WTO Study School in Wuhan, China, and we're the largest WTO Study School on the planet. Right now we're training 800 students. There's a couple things. First, at the beginning of the segment, you said China was the world's largest exporter. That's mm-hmm. not true. China's the third largest exporter, having just surpassed Japan. The United States and Germany are in front of China. Second thing is, Clyde Prestowitz and others like him during the 1980s were bellyaching a lot about the rise of Japan, and look what happened. Now they're bellyaching about China and India. But the comment I wanted to make is, you know, a lot of blame's being placed on China for becoming competitive and growing. The United States, since the end of World War II, has been pushing a global free trade agenda, asking everybody who can come in to come in. It's the president and his corporate allies on Wall Street that are pushing this agenda. American corporations and corporations from developed countries are doing the bulk of the investment in China, and now all of a sudden China is the bad guy. China has agreed to play by rules set by the United States and Washington. It's now playing by the rules, and it's succeeding according to those rules, but now all of a sudden China's the enemy and China's to blame. I think this is highly dangerous. and that Americans who feel that China's a threat really ought to point the finger where it belongs. And
Well, to be fair, Clyde Prestowitz, I think, is in his book, having read it, is pointing out some facts. I don't think he necessarily sees China as a threat. Well, speak for yourself, Mr. Prestowitz.
Yeah, no, I think probably, Oren, you haven't read my new book, 3 Billion New Capitalists. I frankly agree with you. I don't think China is a threat. I think there's been an overreaction about China in the U.S. and in other parts of the world. I think you're mistaken. If you say I'm bellyaching about China, I'm not. I think that, in fact, the really dangerous thing would be the failure of China. I think one of the ironies of the current situation is that, as you point out, the U.S. government, both Democrat and Republican administrations, over the last 20 years have really encouraged China to join the world trading system and have certainly encouraged American investment in China. Now that China, and they did that based on the notion that as China became more integrated in the world economy and became a more capitalist, market-driven economy, that it would also become more democratic. Well, that seems to be happening. And now that China is succeeding, there has been some angst in some places. But I think that we have to hope that China will succeed. I think the issue is very much in the United States and how the United States responds to China in a positive, constructive way. I think it's also a big issue for Americans as to how America maintains its own productivity, its own capacity to offer opportunity and innovation in the future. I mean, in my book, I make the point that if you thought of the globalization as kind of like a game of bridge, and you ask yourself, and each country has a hand of cards, and you ask yourself which hand you'd like to play, I'd like to play the American hand. The Americans, I think, have the best cards. But okay, if you play bridge, you understand that you can lose even if you have the best cards if you play them badly. And right now, I think the United States is playing its cards very badly. We're not doing what we should be doing in education. We're not doing what we should be doing in balancing the federal budget deficit. We're not investing in new technology. We're not investing in fundamental infrastructure. My focus here really is very much on what we ought to be doing to improve our performance and how we can do that to take advantage of the opportunities that China offers.
Yeah, well, I think that that's, you know, definitely the correct way to go. I think there are, you know, there are reactionary forces in China and nationalistic forces.
Yes, of course.
And when the United States, blames, it increases the strength of those forces within China.
Yeah, no, exactly. If I could just add one other thing, you mentioned Japan, and you gave the impression that you think Japan is finished. And certainly Japan has had a tough time macroeconomically in the last 10 years. But I think it's fair to point out that the Japanese auto companies are eating Detroit's lunch. Toyota will surpass GM in the next few years as the world's biggest auto company.
I didn't suggest that Japan was finished. It's just in the 1980s, if you remember.
I remember really well.
Yeah, you remember really well. There was a whole scare about Japan, and here we are. But I would say Japan is finished in Asia compared to China.
Yes, yes.
I think that, and the Japanese recognize that, and they're having some difficulty with
yes.
it. But anyway,
the
point that I just wanted to make is I think it's important that before we start pointing a finger at China, we really need to understand the global context in which this is happening. And this is a global context which has been shaped by the United States since World War II and over the last 20 years directly with China.
I think you're just reiterating Mr. Prestowitz's first chapter.
Okay, good.
All right. Thank you very much.
Read the book.
All right. Yeah, bye-bye.
Thanks for the phone call. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Pam. Pam calling from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
Our daughter is from China, and we went there last year to adopt her and fell in love with China. Obviously, it holds a dear place in our heart. But I've read in several articles over the past year that unemployment is very low in China. And with the one-child policy, what does the future hold economically for China in terms of workers and all the factories?
Yes, we certainly heard about aging demography in Europe. Right. It's also going to happen in China.
At the moment, I would say China has a lot of what we would call underemployment. That is, there are 700 or 800 million peasants who are still on the farm, and those people are nominally employed, I guess, but they don't work very much, actually. So China has a lot of underemployment, and one of the things it's trying to do is to grow its industrial economy to soak up those people so that they become fully employed. In the long term, however, China faces a very daunting demographic problem, because the one-child policy means that within about 15 years, China will begin to age very rapidly. And by the 2040s, the population of China will be shrinking. India will actually surpass China as to become the largest country in terms of population in the world. And the Chinese will face a very difficult challenge, because they'll have a lot of old people on pension and a very small base of young people to fund those pensions. Actually, there's a lot of discussion in China these days about changing the one-child policy, because this is looking like such a disaster down the road.
Pam, thank you.
Thankfully, they are, because it was just an amazing experience to go over there, but it's also extremely sad to see all the orphans. And
yes, of course.
The policy just changed very soon.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Pam.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. One of the things we talked about, American investment in China, one of the things you write about is conditions of Chinese workers at various factories. A Nike factory you visited, subcontractor to Nike, where you describe conditions as not unpleasant. And another factory, which manufactures goods for Walmart, which you describe as a sweatshop.
Yes. There's a great variation of conditions in China. And if you were working there yourself, you'd rather work in the Nike plant than in some of these factories in Dongguan, which are, you know, producing a lot of the exports that come here. I think that on the one hand, conditions have improved a lot over the last 10 or 15 years generally in China. But the impact of multinational companies like Nike, for example, has been quite positive in raising standards for working conditions.
Tell us about, there were some fascinating characters you met, including a silk manufacturer named Cole Wai. Tell us about him.
Yeah, I met him at his factory in Shanghai, and when I arrived at the factory, he had just come back from putting his daughter on the airplane to go to L.A., where she's going to university. He was talking on two cell phones at the same time. We went into his plant, and it didn't look like any textile factory I'd been in. It looked more like a lot of the high-tech plants in Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke with this guy for 2 hours, during which he took a constant stream of calls on both cell phones. A real wheeler-dealer. But he started off working in a state-owned Chinese textile factory, and then after the opening up of the Chinese economy in the late 1980s, made contacts in Hong Kong, somehow got some capital, got a contract actually to supply Walmart.
With undershirts.
With undershirts. Rented a few warehouses, got some sewing machines, and went into business. Quickly figured out that selling to Walmart is not the way to get rich. Decided to go in for his own brand. And so he now is into high-end silk textiles with his own brand, and dreaming of buying brands in the U.S.
And Italy.
And in Italy, and becoming the next Gucci or Pucci. He's clearly thinking big.
Here's an email question from David House. In any discussion of capitalism in China, it's very important to point out that the Chinese government is the majority owner of the majority of all businesses in China. This was brought home to us earlier this year when we went to China to negotiate with a Chinese hearing aid company to produce the world's first practical, low-cost, high-quality cochlear implant. The peculiar irony, then, is that one of the last remaining communist regimes in the world is perhaps one of the largest capitalist conglomerates in the world.
Absolutely. That statement captures really the essence of a lot of China.
But does the government, is the majority owner in most enterprises?
Well, in a lot. But this is also a holdover or a residual from the fact that the government used to own everything. And the government has been disposing of its holdings and getting out of enterprises, but it still is a big holder in many enterprises.
We are talking with Clyde Prestowitz. He's the author of 3 Billion New Capitalists, The Great Shift of Wealth and Power to the East, a book about how U.S. policy ought to be changed regarding economic policy regarding the East. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. And this will be Nina. Nina calling us from Spring Branch in Texas.
Hi. I was just wondering if, U.S. corporations, like Walmart, for example, was going to take responsibility for, like, the human rights violations and how, like, our policy can allow that, I mean, allow businesses to even operate like that.
Well, our corporations cannot and will not take responsibility for human rights violations by the Chinese government. Now, U.S. corporations that operate in China are responsible for how they treat their own employees, and generally speaking, they treat them quite well, and they apply U.S. standards to human rights within the area of their own responsibility. But they're not responsible for the actions or the policies of the Chinese government. That's more a matter of the U.S. government. As you know, the U.S. government frequently pressures the Chinese to improve their human rights performance, and with some success.
But as you point out in the book, in the Nike factory, where you said conditions are not unpleasant,
right.
There are people sent around. I think Andrew Young, the former, is involved in inspecting to make sure. This, admittedly, after Nike had considerable problems, publicity problems with their conditions in some of their factories. Walmart does not take the same kind of responsibility?
Well, to be honest, I don't know exactly what Walmart's policies are, but I would say that there's a variation among U.S. companies, and as you point out, Nike had had some previous problems, and as a result of that, they vowed to become purer than Caesar's wife, and so they have instituted this policy where they have Andrew Young and other commissions periodically inspect their factories. Other companies do similar things, but there is a variation in practice. But again, I think the main point here is this. When people talk about human rights in China, what they're really talking about is the lack of the rule of law, the lack of constitutional freedoms that we take for granted. And those kinds of issues are...
Not to mention Tibet and some other issues.
Those kinds of issues are not things that American corporations can take any responsibility for. Those are things that are government-to-government issues, and the U.S. government does operate on those issues.
Thanks very much for the call, Nina.
Thank you. China,
as you point out, a lot of people think, well, low-cost labor, as you point out, an almost endless supply of low-cost labor.
Right.
But labor's cheaper in other places, Vietnam, parts of Thailand,
yes.
You say Africa.
Yes.
What gives China an advantage?
It's not just low-cost labor. It's also the fact that the labor is reasonably well-educated and skilled. It's literate. And it is also married to pretty good infrastructure. The Chinese have built railroads and roads, and particularly telecommunications facilities and port facilities, so that they have a, in many parts of the country, a very modern infrastructure that greatly enhances the productivity of these reasonably skilled, low-cost workers.
Yet at the same time, the tremendous liberalization in the economy, China's political system, has not kept pace with that. As you create a middle class, they're going to want a voice.
They are going to want a voice, and I would say they have much more of a voice. I mean, if you compare the life of the average Chinese today and his or her ability to, one, have a voice, two, make decisions, fundamental decisions regarding his or her own life, the difference between today and 25 years ago is just black and white, night and day. I mean, 25 years ago, you married who the party told you to marry. You worked in the factory the party told you to work in. Everything was tied to that factory. Today, you choose your own vocation. I mean, it's just the rights, the freedom of the average individual have tremendously advanced.
Clyde Prestowitz, thanks very much for talking with us. Your book is about a great deal more than just China, but it's a big element to it. We appreciate your focus
on
that.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Clyde Prestowitz's new book is 3 Billion New Capitalists, The Great Shift of Wealth and Power to the East. This the first in what's going to be a series of conversations about America's evolving relationship with China. When we come back from a short break, the latest news from London on this morning's small explosions there, plus an update on the investigation into the bombings that hit London exactly 2 weeks ago. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.